Well, hello again. This is, well, I say again, this is a brand new kind of thing for us, for the Patreon supporters. Thanks, everyone. And some other people as well. I'm David Robertson.
I'm Christopher Carter, and we're joined from across the other side of the world, live by...
Brianne Fallon. Hello. It's lovely to see you all. Hear you all.
Indeed. How are you? How are you, Brianne? How's work?
Oh, work's pretty good down at the Sydney Jewish Museum. It's very busy educating a lot of people about Judaism and the Holocaust. So keeps me busy, must say.
Oh, heady stuff indeed. And, you know, paying your rent, which is great. So the format of the show, we haven't got a name for the show yet. So if we think of one during the show, we might say at the end. But otherwise, you know... suggestions to Twitter, please. But the format of this show is we're going to take a more current affairs kind of look at the field. And by the field, I mean the sort of critical approach that we do rather than your usual news story format. And we're just going to go around, share some stories that we've heard in the last couple of weeks that we think might be interesting to listeners and expose some of the concerns we have, that critical unpacking of the category and also exposing how the category is working in the public sphere. So let's kick off, Brianne. I believe you've got a story for us from Australia.
Yes, from down under. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you are on the other side of the world with our current state of politics. We like to change prime ministers very frequently. When I say like, of course, people don't like it, but we actually haven't had a prime minister sit a full term since before Twitter was invented, which just is really sad. So we've just recently changed prime ministers over to a gentleman named Scott Morrison, or fondly known in the media as ScoMo, a very Aussie term for you all. And there has just been this obsession with Scott Morrison's faith. Now, we're not – Christian prime ministers aren't anything new to us, but the thing with Scott Morrison is that he is openly Pentecostal. And this, I think, has provided a lot of media fire, in particular around the concept of – how much his church is connected to the Hillsong Church. So Scott Morrison is a member of a church called Horizon in the Sutherland Shire, a sort of beachy suburb south of the centre of Sydney. And everywhere you look on the media, there's these – Hillsong is just everywhere. You know, he's connected to Hillsong. And actually, in Scott Morrison's 2008 maiden speech in Parliament, he thanked Brian Houston, one of the big wigs of Hillsong, for all of his support. And I think Australia is really struggling with having such an overtly religious prime minister at the helm. And this really all came to a head when, during the week, the concept of gay conversion therapy was raised. And Scott Morrison just sort of brushed it off and said, "It's not my issue, so I'm not really interested," which I think really just added fuel to the fire. And now there's this giant argument about religious freedom and what it means to be in power and be somebody of overt faith. And really, I think Australia is just up in arms about the concept of a Pentecostalist being at the helm.
What's the usual religious position of kind of political functionaries in Australia? I mean, here everybody is kind of, you can get away with being Jewish. And increasingly kind of, you see a lot of Muslim councillors and so on. But kind of, if you're in office, you're not really allowed to be a Catholic. You've got to be sort of implicitly Church of England.
And you certainly can't talk about it,
Right. Well, it doesn't really sort of matter, I guess, sort of what faith you are. We've had Catholics, we've had Uniting Church Anglicans. If you're Christian, it really doesn't seem to matter. And it's understood that that will inform your choices, but you're really not meant to lead with your faith sort of front and center. Having said that, I do think that it sort of permeates a lot of our politicians' decisions. For example, Scott Morrison, he abstained most recently on our we had a plebiscite in regards to same-sex marriage, and he abstained and he said he did that because of his own personal faith grounds. Now, that's technically not how a plebiscite works. He is supposed to vote on behalf of his constituency, but he abstained because he himself didn't think that there should have been any question about same-sex marriage. So I think that while in theory that shouldn't be leading people's decision-making when they're in the parliament, it clearly is. And another point that was very interesting when Scott Morrison came to power is that another politician, Josh Frydenberg, was actually sworn in as, I think, deputy PM. Don't quote me on that, but he was the first Jewish person to make it that high up, and he was actually sworn in with a kippah and on the Torah, and that made the news as well because the Jewish community finally felt like they were going to be represented. So there seems to be this weird balance between this idea that you're supposed to represent your constituency no matter who it's made up of and actually what people are doing in the parliament. It seems to be much more faith-based once people are actually in power or in leadership.
How are you finding the discourse then, you know, so from a sort of critical RS perspective, how is the category of religion being deployed? How are the media reacting to this? How are people thinking religion, whatever it is, should be implicated in the state? And have there been any interesting moments, like teachable moments that you might use?
Yeah, I think for me, I read a really interesting article when I was thinking about this episode, and one person in the media said, "Australia isn't a secular nation. Australia is a free nation." And I thought that was a really interesting sort of play up on our favorite concept of secularization and this idea that Australia is actually about freedom of religion rather than secularization. And in that way, the media have been talking about Australia as though there are lots of different faiths and there will be people of the parliament of lots of different faiths being represented, as opposed to this overarching sort of middle ground of secularization and you hide your religion from the public. So there's been much more dialogue about the idea of religion being a public thing and there being many, as opposed to hiding it in a secular state. And I actually think, to be perfectly honest, I think the idea of freedom of religion in the public, I actually think that's frightening people. I actually think that people are quite afraid and prefer to sort of rest in the comfort of the idea of secularization. And there's this great movement here around, are secularization and freedom of religion the same things? Are they at odds with each other? They're mutually exclusive. And this dialogue in the media is really, really interesting.
That's excellent. And actually, I'm using this as a segue into something I wanted to speak about, because a story that I was asked to comment on here in Scotland was about, the headline was, "We no longer go to church, but many Scots still have a belief in angels and devils." And it was a survey. Of course, it was research published by the Humanist Society Scotland, which automatically rings ideological bells. But it was showing that nearly a third of Scots have a belief in angels. Around one in four feel the same about demons and evil spirits. And this seemed to be sort of shocking in the way that the newspaper was reporting it. It was asking, people still have these beliefs. Scotland's meant to be a secular place, isn't it? Where these beliefs aren't going to be so dominant. And so I was contacted by the Herald to give a comment on this, and it was my first time being asked by the media for a comment, and I had been told you need to respond quickly if they ask. So I did respond immediately with just the three things that came to my mind whilst I was in the bathroom reading the email. Didn't get any acknowledgement that they'd even received my reply, and the only acknowledgement I got was finding it in the paper the following day. Now, the first point that I made was that, well, I wasn't surprised that institutional religion or belief in the supernatural are quite different things. And although the cultural cachet of religion and orthodox beliefs associated with whatever it is seem to be declining in Scotland, that doesn't mean that all these other things are apparently going to be declining. I also pointed to the sort of existential security argument that was popularized by Norris and Inglehart, the idea that the less secure we are financially, economically, socially, the more likely, these sorts of extra natural explanations will perhaps be in play. And, you know, with things like Brexit and Trump and so on, that makes a deal of sense. And then I got annoyed with myself and I added a more critical afterword, which of course didn't make it into the paper. And that's where I said that most fundamentally, even the most rationalist of scientific, all these things are in quotation marks, thinkers, won't be this all the time. We all have beliefs in extra natural phenomena, nations, human rights, tradition, aliens, progress, and so on. And many of these are perceived as more, quote, normal than others, but they're given their value by those who believe in them, just like angels, demons, and spirits. And I thought it was more interesting that the paper and the research was saying that people still believe in these things. Isn't that weird? But they weren't challenging all these other beliefs. And I know that this will link into another story that we had about independence in Scotland as well. But it was just interesting that that was the bit that they decided not to include.
Yeah. What's interesting, you pointed out already the sort of evolutionary aspect to that, where it's they still believe these things. Implicitly copying that kind of golden bough model of, we move from superstition to religion to science. And because we're now in science, it makes no sense that we still have superstitions, right?
Exactly.
But, as you said, it's always the weird stuff that gets challenged, whereas the institutionalized weird stuff doesn't get challenged. And I had a similar story when I was having my thesis examined, and one of the examiners, deliberately provoking me, I think he knew what answer he was looking for, said, how do you justify studying these very marginal groups? And I pointed out to him that in terms of numbers, they were actually less marginal than the mainstream beliefs. We have whole departments studying the Church of Scotland in the university, but 49% or 40% or whatever, depending on which survey you ask, are Christian in Scotland today. But something like 60 or 70% believe in some sort of supernatural phenomena, be it aliens, ghosts, angels and demons, right? So in terms of numbers, these are not marginal constructs and social ideas. They're only marginalized in popular discourse and in official discourse because they're considered to be, they're not proper beliefs. They're not things we're allowed to believe.
Does that ring true down under, Brienne?
Yes, I definitely think so. I mean, just talking about the story that I started with, the fact that, being a Pentecostal Christian is an issue as opposed to being a Catholic or an Anglican or Presbyterian or Church of England, this sort of marginal Christianity seems to be the thing that's causing the issue, because you're right, it's marginalized in popular culture, and that connection with Hillsong that we've been seeing in the media is because people, they don't know anything about it, and Hillsong is just to them mega churches, money, and gay conversion therapy. And so there's this fear about the other, and it's really, I think down here, I'm not sure about on your side of the world, but down here I think it's really it's sort of clouding the issues of what really people think about religion. We're just so frightened of things that are different and maybe not mainstream that people just automatically put it in the too hard basket, and the media does the same thing. And there's no sort of discussion more broadly about what might be good about Pentecostalism, if you want to use that word. And so these groups remain marginalized really because of that fear.
This is, it's quite a good segue actually to jump to another story that I had lined up, which I was worried might come across as a here's the freak of the week kind of thing, but it fits perfect. So it's about, so we're going to America now and we're going to meet Rodriguez Aguilera, who is, Bettina Rodriguez Aguilera, who is running for Congress in Miami. And she's been getting quite a lot of press recently because she is quite open about the fact that she had an alien abduction experience when she was a child, in which she described three beings, two women and a man, who she described as being tall and full-figured, spoke to her telepathically, took her aboard a spaceship, and where she saw round seats, apparently a strange detail. So there's quite a big debate at the moment about whether she should be allowed to run for office because, you know, if she believes in alien abduction, then she's clearly mad, right? Or this is the narrative that's being put forward. And so the whole debate is around whether she's mad or normal, or they like her because she's honest and so on and so forth. However, don't forget, though, that this is a predominantly Catholic area, and particularly in the Hispanic community. And there's absolutely no question as to whether having Catholic beliefs would be irrational, but they have just as little rational grounds for believing in them as the alien story does.
Oh, I don't really have anything more to add, except that, you know, it's further evidence from another context of, yeah, the implicit biases in what is considered sort of normal and okay, and what is considered weird and needs to be policed or people need to be reprimanded for. Going back to, you know, one story that we were going to potentially discuss, but we probably don't have time, is about Scottish independence being branded as a belief that's worthy of protection or sort of exemptions and things. But, you know, we have all these conversations about, going back to my interview with, say, Matt Francis about radicalization. You know, we talk about people being radicalized into extreme views, like the people who may want to attack the state in some way. But what about all those people who are radicalized into wanting to kill people on behalf of the state in what we call the armed forces? We think one is normal and totally legit, and we think one is weird and needs to be clamped down upon. And it's exactly the same in these sort of like Catholic beliefs, okay. Alien beliefs, not so okay. And, you know, it's contextual. It depends which one has a lengthy tradition of being in an area and being sort of seen as legit. But once tradition's invoked, these things aren't challenged.
Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, so let's talk about this Scottish nationalism story, because I think it's very interesting. Did this make it across to Australia, Brianne? Did you hear about this?
Absolutely not. This has definitely not made the news over here. We're too busy worrying about Scott Morrison and his church going to listen about what's going on in other parts of the world.
Oh, quite right, yeah. ScoMo's Pentecostalism is quite a serious issue. Okay, so the story here was this, this was in the report in the Scottish papers maybe 2 weeks ago. And it's about a guy called Chris McElhenney, who worked at the Ministry of Defence site in Inverclyde. And he was a group leader in the Inverclyde Council for the SNP, the Scottish Nationalist Party. When he announced that he was going to run to become deputy leader in 2016, he was suspended by the Ministry of Defence with his security clearance revoked. And apparently, or his claim is that national security officials came to his house and asked him about his, support for independence, social media activity, mental health. And he then formally resigned and pursued a discrimination case against the Ministry of Defence, basically saying, you know, unfair dismissal because of the fact that he was supporting a political position that was in opposition to the government's stance. But the only way that he could put this case forward was to argue that it was a philosophical, that nationalism was a philosophical belief, and therefore a protected characteristic under the 2010 Equality Act. Amazingly, the judge upheld this. Mm. Although this isn't a final ruling, this was a preliminary ruling, but the judge said that the claimant has persuaded me that his belief in Scottish independence has a sufficiently similar cogency to a religious belief to qualify as a philosophical belief. And this involves, for this to be true, it had to be A, genuinely held, involve moral and ethical conviction, relate to weighty and substantial aspects of human life and behaviour. And there are so many interesting aspects there of what religion is in, well, in the Scottish legal system, but also in popular discourse there, that I think this is just a fascinating story.
I love the mention of, what was it, weighty and substantial areas of human life? Is that what the wording was?
Yeah, exactly. Weighty and substantial aspects of human life.
From my understanding of definitions of religion that we have in the academy, that idea of, you know, how do you show that something that is, you know, generally has some sort of impact on the person. And that sort of language there is very interesting, because it's not talking about, you know, a supernatural weightiness. It's just some sort of sense of morality and ethics, but in a different way. And that definitely seems to be sort of moving more into these ideas around populism, as we're seeing that sort of rise around the world, and this idea of sort of what drives you as a person. This idea of sort of, it really reminds me of Tillichian ultimate concern, that seems to be really at the heart there of that that decision there.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
And just to add a sort of further fuel to the fire, the statement, I guess, or ruling went on that the belief must also attain, quote, a certain level of cogency, seriousness, cohesion, and importance, and also, quote, be worthy of respect in a democratic society.
There's so many value judgments here, you know. I mean, who decides what's worthy of respect? I mean, surely this court case is about whether it's worthy of respect in the first place. So, you know, there's kind of a logical loop there. But, you know, like, what makes something a weighty question? What makes, you know, how do you decide if something's serious or not? What is, you know, weighty or substantial? Who decides those things? Because, I mean, you know, for me, a lot of those questions that, you know, devout Christians are going to talk about aren't necessarily the same ones I would weigh.
Exactly. And my presumption is that this gentleman will have had to have demonstrated that they, you know, attended meetings on a regular basis, that their friend group was made up largely of people with the same view, that their view had been held for a sufficiently long time, that it was backed up with scripture-like sources and a sort of philosophical tradition, and that they were heavily invested in it financially and in terms of their time and so on, which all sounds very like, and the fact that they had to say it's like a religion, so things are still, there's a model there of this thing that is set apart as special, as worthy of special attention, and that is being judged against that.
Right, yeah. Why do religions deserve protection, but other, you know, political and, you know, other kinds of convictions and beliefs don't? That's the underlying narrative here.
Well, and they do, as long as they can show themselves to be religion-like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, the sacrality is crossing the borders there. If his, you know, position on Scottish independence is sacred, then that sort of boundary of what is sacred and what isn't completely falls away, and the idea of the special just completely opens up altogether.
And this ties right into the sort of final story that we wanted to mention. It's the Commission on RE in it's England and Wales, but it's of impact, well, for us in Scotland and more broadly, because it's been a massive report produced in consultation with teachers, politicians, and importantly, academics in actual religious studies, making recommendations for what happens in secondary level, I'll say religious education in England and Wales. But one of the chief recommendations was a change from religious education to religion and world views, which ties interestingly into that last point. Of course, there's a whole variety of issues that we might have with this, with the report. I'm not a fan of the word world views, although I'm still not sure what I would want in its place. But it is interesting to see, that they're sort of considering, inclusivity, a more broad curriculum, a more, nuanced and non-confessional curriculum, and making a real argument for the perceived necessity of this subject area within secondary education in the UK. And we're going to run, hopefully, a special on this with Wendy Dossett and some others who've been quite heavily involved, but we just wanted to mention it. Do you have any immediate thoughts on it, David?
I've only read the summary so far. As you said, we're going to have a full-sized episode on this. But I think one thing that's quite pertinent to the discussion we've been having today is, you know, the first line in the summary. The study of religious and non-religious worldviews is a core component of an academic education. And it's this religious and non-religious thing that it's like, why do we need to have that distinction there at all? It seems to me to be kind of falling between two stools, where they want to say this is about the way that, you know, the systems and the ways that people understand the world. It's not entirely about religion, but yet they also have this implicit kind of category of religion. So worldviews are defined by whether they're religion or they're not religion. So, you know, there's still something special about this thing called religion, which is, you know, is specific. And it's kind of, I think this is a step forward in a lot of ways, but it underlines the problem here, which is, what is the point of RE? Is it to teach about religions or is it to teach about worldviews? And if it's to teach about worldviews and broader ways in which people understand the world, why don't we just drop the religion part of the title and just call it worldviews, and then we can teach about religions as part of that? It seems to be constantly falling between two stools. It's got a desire to broaden it out, so it's saying, oh, we're not just teaching you about the Church of England. But then they're also, they keep needing to put stress how important and special religion is at the same time. They can't quite get a way of doing it.
And right at the very end of the executive summary, their sort of 11th recommendation is that the Department for Education should review the right of withdrawal from religion and worldviews and then provide a few clarifications. But they're not saying it should be scrapped. So my sort of takeaway from it is there's still this model that there's this subject that's apparently essential to education, to a full academic education, but we're still allowing parents to exempt students from it. Would we allow them to exempt students from maths, from English lit, from various forms of science? Probably not. They're considered core. So the whole subject is still being singled out as problematic, and that certain students may not want to learn about it or shouldn't be able to learn about it, or their parents should be able to step in and say, I don't want my children learning about this, which implies that there is something more going on than sort of neutral critical discussion of worldviews. It implies that there is still some value thing going on there, even if they're trying to get away from it, and they're not seeming to be willing to challenge the broad notion that this is a protected special area that people need to be saved from hearing the wrong information.
Or possibly that that parents have the right to isolate their children from things which challenge religious worldviews, but not other things. You know, you can't protect them from hearing about science, for instance, or maths, as you know, the examples you gave. But you can protect them from hearing things that might contradict your religious beliefs, because, again, religion is something special.
And as I say, we'll get back to this, but Brianne, again, you probably hadn't heard about this, but any thoughts on what we're saying?
It's actually really interesting, because our RE education, it blew up a couple of years ago, and the argument has sort of petered off since then. But basically, I'm not sure you know how much you know about our RE system, but basically in primary school, on your way in, your parent ticks a box as to what religion class you may like to go to, all confessional. And if you want to opt out, then you get to go to ethics in inverted commas class. So it was really interesting to me when you were talking about this idea of religious and non-religious worldviews, because ours is actually sort of set up that way. You either go to your religious class to get your worldviews, or you go to an ethics class and get your worldviews from there. But if you go to ethics class, you're learning from philosophers and sociologists. You're not actually learning about the different types of worldviews. You're just learning it without a religious lens. There's actually no point at which this is about a non-confessional study and we're learning about different faiths and not even from different people. I mean, RE is largely taught in our schools by people of the faith, and ethics is an issue there because we don't necessarily have people trained in that sort of space to teach those classes. And so it's all just really, it's just all up in the air here at the moment. It's causing a little bit of debate. And I think particularly for me, I would really love to see religion as something that is treated as a subject of value, that this isn't just something that you study for 1 hour a week. It's something that we put a lot of time and effort into to understand other cultures. And in particular, I think it's really important because as you both raised, you know, parents can't pull you out of science or maths or English. And there seems to be this fundamental misunderstanding that religion may come up in other subjects. It may come up in English lit. It may come up in history. And to not have a framework through which to understand that when you get in those other subjects, to me just seems like we're all just going to start on the back foot here.
It actually takes us right back full circle to where we started, because we're talking about these different ways in which the secular state and the secular education and the secular law indeed are set up, and the inherent problems they run into with this non-secular category that we're all forced to deal with. Any last thoughts, Chris, before we wrap up?
Well, just on that, I'm remembering Celine Benoit's presentation at the BASR conference, which was an excellent conference, if I do say so myself, where she was talking to, I think it was primary school pupils, about how they found religious education. And they all basically saw it as a nice way to make them feel welcome, to make them feel welcome, or so that when we go there, we don't offend them. And that was the sort of broad takeaway. It wasn't seen as sort of relevant to everyday life in any way, but it was sort of making them feel welcome and making sure we don't offend them when we go to their space.
Yeah, so I remember there was a quote she had there. The kid was asked what religion they were, and they went, "Oh, I don't really have a religion. I'm just, you know, normal English." Brianne, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you. Would you be up for doing this again, maybe?
100%. I think this was really great. It's really interesting to talk about how religion is reverberating all around the world in very actually similar ways, and to sort of see how, you know, looking at the world as a whole sort of gives us a sense that perhaps there are sort of grand trends going on, and perhaps what the three of us are doing at work on a daily basis is actually, you know, affecting people in the real world. It's great to see the real world effect of this sort of in an everyday sense.
Absolutely. Well, maybe we'll get one set up with two people in Australia, and we'll get a little bit more of your kind of context down there. But for now, Brianne, thanks, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep. See you guys soon.